to another episode of Safe and Effective, the Medical Human Factors Podcast. Right away, I have to admit, not only did I manage to squeeze in one of my absolute favorite topics again, but also with that, bring back one of my most favorite humans as the special guest to discuss it with me, Dr. Bert Bouquet. Dr. Bouquet is a professor of human factors and behavioral neurobiology at my alma mater, Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida. He's a genius at teaching, rocks the stats any day, and undoubtedly is one of the funniest humans I have ever had the pleasure to call my friend. Well, let me think. Maybe I'm a bit biased. Stats geeks usually don't often come in funny form, do they? Anyway, with that being said, now over to Bert.
Well, hello there, Bert. Thank you for coming on and being on my podcast again.
Hi. Thank you for having me. Always happy to.
Of course. And I have invited Bert on today to talk about use errors and how to move the needle forward on developing collective terminology and definition thereof, and sort of build a database inhabiting a classification system and standard that allows us in our industry to not only build a collectively agreed upon system and definitions, but instead would reduce subjectively biased definitions and classifications of use errors that basically portray the same type of behaviors in contextual circumstances. Now, for this, of course, I had to invite Bert on because he's my good friend and my partner in statistics and my mentor in understanding and developing a scientific mind and approach to study design, data collection, and statistical analysis. Now, Bert has requested that I play Chariots of Fire when he's introduced and then cue in James Earl Jones.
Yeah.
Because, and I quote, he's powerful and soothing, according to Bert. But in light that I do not have access to those songs or rights, I figure, Bert, maybe me just saying hello and welcome would do the trick.
Fine. That will do fine, Heidi.
All right. Well, Bert, I figure it would be awesome for you to start a little bit about the history of use errors and why you and I have even talked about this in the past and why it's such a critical topic that I constantly bring up because I do see a lack of a collectively understood and agreed upon kind of classification system. And I do see a lot of variability still in people defining and classifying almost the same behaviors independent from medical device design.
Right.
And with that, I've always seen kind of like a missing tool, a missed opportunity for us to develop something that pretty much exists in other industries pretty commonly.
Yes. So, I mean, I can give you a little bit of the background how I got here from there, if you will. So historically, if you look at, or at least in my experience, in which I kind of date back to the FAA when I was working there, and first started working in the accident investigative side, and more importantly, in the error side, root cause analysis and things like that. And what struck me in terms of reading accident reports and things like that is how we talked about human error. There was no question that is the number one issue in aviation accidents. It was at the time, it is still today, and that's true for most accidents and incidents. It really doesn't matter what the industry is. And the frustrating thing is that you tended to see the same things repeat over and over again. And pilot error, pilot decision making, this, that, and the other thing. I don't have to tell you as a pilot, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Well, it's always our fault.
Well, of course. And that really went against everything I had learned, certainly as a psychologist. And with my early training coming from people who were what you would only consider today very traditional behavioral psychologists. And that is that when we look at errors, and the way I treat errors, I think about them as no different than any other behavior. It's just a maladaptive behavior within a given circumstance. So given that, the real issue is what about the system, whatever the system is generating that behavior. So if it's the correct behavior, what is it about the system that's generating the correct behavior? But we almost never pay any attention to that. For obvious reasons, we pay attention to the errors, mistakes, and things like that. So the same question, though, applies is what's generating that. And what we saw was that the typical types of root cause analyses that we see, which were really foundationally rooted in engineering, were inadequate to address human error. Because unlike a machine where a single failure results in that cascade of events that ends up with a catastrophic failure, that's not how humans operate. So behaviors in humans, adaptive or maladaptive, correct behavior or errors, are multiply determined. And so we needed a different way to go about doing that. And more important, if we were really going to address failure in a system, we had to have a common language to do so, so that we're all saying the same thing, whether it's a slip, trip, or fall, whether it's decision error, whether it's a violation, or we all call in it the same thing, and it doesn't mean the same thing to all of us. That really was the key.
And you've said before that, and I listen to this a lot in my head because you've said this so many times throughout knowing you. Before we were friends and you were just the teacher that I hated because you taught statistics. Come on.
Like you were amongst many.
I mean, the sheer intimidation I had of that class going into it and my preconceived notion of what stats was, because to me, it was just math and I didn't like math. You've always said that you cannot treat use errors and classify and define and analyze them the way you do in engineering because humans aren't systems.
Right.
And so when we look at medical device development, for example, yes, our devices are systems. But when we conduct root cause analysis, our main goal usually, especially during validation, is to discern whether it is design related or whether it is behavioral related.
Right.
So is it really the use of it or the user, or is it a design flaw that either supports and exacerbates a mistake coming up, a use error, so to speak, or is it something that is functionally wrong? That then is a nuance within the design. So is it because the design is unfortunate and it leads to misunderstanding and therefore use errors, or is it functionally when they press A, the system spits out B? I mean, that's a complete different type. And when I then look at use errors, when I conduct validations, I often go back to that kind of teaching where I really bring it back to basics and I really only classify them as, is this, as we spoke about so many times, is this skill-based? Is this decision-making error? Is this a violation that leads to basically abnormal use? Or is it design-related? And then if it's design-related, I want to understand what really of the design is leading to this particular use error.
Right.
But when you look at behavior, you have to look at so many nuances that we often oversee, especially in validation testing. You know, we come in with these scripts and we have these definitions and we've defined what this is and we've defined what that is. You know, is it success? Is it fail? Is it a close call? We in the medical device industry, human factors, when I say we,
right,
we understand those are the major types and classifications. But those are not the root cause classifications. And that's what you and I are talking about today. So just for the audience, I'm not trying to regurgitate or renegotiate what a fail is, what a success is, and what a close call is, and what an assist is, and all these different things that we've already agreed upon. No, what I'm saying is I often see similar types of behaviors and similar actions and thinking differently defined and differently classified. And what I mean by that is more from a perspective of you're doing the research, meaning you're validating. I know that people sometimes misunderstand that not being research because it's a validation study, but it's still part of research.
Yes.
And what I then see is typically maybe human factors expert A has defined it as a negative transfer because the person during the debrief has mentioned that it similarly looks like device XYZ. But I or somebody else, human factors expert B, might have classified it as habitual because you found out during debrief or during the intro that they typically work in this environment and they use this and their daily workflow is XYZ and then they do task ABC typically in fashion A. And so I would then say, okay, well, that's habitual. And then another person would say, but that's negative transfer. Now, we both are defining and classifying almost the same type of behavior as two different things. And so what it leads to is this tremendously subjectively biased defining and classifying of use errors. And combine that with the fact that our data usually isn't public data. We don't make it available to others because there's so much confidentiality within our industry.
Right.
Now you have thousands of devices going onto the market, going through validations, human factors validation, summative testing, with reports that may, on the surface of it, look like we're all kind of using the same. But if you go deep into the behaviors of the use errors and the nuances within, of course, independent from device design,
right,
you find that we don't all agree upon the same. And so one thing that I've always admired about your HVAC system is this idea of having a database that is collectively agreed upon, that this is the type of behavior you're looking for. It is defined as this and it's classified as that. You add to it, you take out of it, you take it as a guidance, you use it as your tool to classify and define, but you also add to it, meaning the more people add to it, the more robust it becomes.
Right.
So my vision always was, and still is, that we figure a way out in our industry to agree upon something like the mod database. We agree upon something where we all port into and we take the information that gets added, the data, and then a group, like all these groups that do exist already, ISO groups, AMI groups, right? We take a group that is responsible and takes care of this and maintains it and dwindles it down and figures out a way to come up with these groups, these classifications,
right,
and then turns around, makes that available again. So we start over, we've talked about this before, whether it takes a couple of years or maybe it takes a whole decade, I don't know. But I could envision something like this building very quickly with all of the different devices that we put on the market these days. We could easily have something like this up and running in a couple of years and feed into it. And then we would finally, I mean, eliminate as ambitious, but at least reduce, like I said in the beginning, reduce the subjectively biased defining and classifying use errors that aren't ultimately, really, at the root cause of it, the same.
Yeah. And I mean, that would be the ultimate goal, right? Where you get to where we're all speaking the same language. And certainly within organizations, you can do that. I mean, we've trained numerous organizations on HVACs and they're using it. Embry-Riddle is one. They've used it for many years. And you thus build on that system. You add data because at the end of the day, safety, whether you're talking about medical devices, flying airplanes, driving cars, it's a data-driven process. And so the more data you have, the more you know where are the problems out there, what are the true threats for whatever system that we're using. And so for people, and you're right, we're not an engineered system. I mean, if you really think about people, we're a biopsychosocial system. And your interest here is the interface between two systems. One is that biopsychosocial system and the technical system that they're using, whatever that piece of equipment is, whatever the piece of technology is. And so what are the potential problems with that interface, right? What are the weaknesses? What are the flaws? What do we need to address? And by having that language, if you will, you begin to see not only what the use errors are, what the problems are, but which ones you need to address first. So now you have the capacity to prioritize what needs to be fixed first.
Yeah.
And that is a critical component, because if I told you that forgetting something on a specific list is by far your most common problem that you have, that's your most common error, yet it doesn't result in any negative consequences, okay, that moves down the list. But if I have one that is much more rare, where I administer too much or too little of a drug that does have serious consequences, that's a priority. I'm going to address that first. And so the other thing that it allows you to do is to kind of triage or stage where you intervene. And you can also intervene at multiple levels, because if we're not speaking the same language, I don't know if I need to intervene on the technical side, or do I need to intervene on the person side? Is this a training issue? Is this a redesign issue? Is this a timing issue? I don't know. If my data is limited, I'm really just guessing. And ultimately, your goal should be, how do I, you'll never eliminate the errors, but what you can do, if you've collected enough data, and if the data is in a format that's relatable, now I can work towards mitigating those things. That's what you really want. So what we really do on the safety side, as you know, is we don't eliminate risk, we manage it.
Right.
Managing risk is a data-driven process.
And I mean, to be fair, that is the same approach we have. We have a risk-based approach, right? Risk mitigation, that's what we actually call them as well. We manage risk. We classify foreseen and already discovered use errors in severity levels of criticality. So that is our type of prioritization. But I think what is so nuanced and what you just brought up that's so important is what now typically happens is you look at the use errors that were related to critical tasks. Critical tasks are defined and identified by severity risk. And that is absolutely how it should be done. I'm not questioning that.
Of course.
What I'm questioning is then, if you then have that, but now your use error wasn't design related and is behavioral related, why is it behavioral related?
Right.
And within that, that's where you see the cherry pick behavior, what you were saying so much more eloquently with prioritizing and how to prioritize. But that's what I always call the cherry pick behavior, where, you know, in software development, we call it the low hanging fruit. It's easy fixes. And nobody's saying that manufacturers aren't dedicating to making the safest devices out there. What I'm trying to say is it is all kind of like, as funny and as ridiculous almost as it still sounds, so far into human factors and the existence of behavioral psychology and what we've been doing in medical device development, and with the FDA putting out such great guidances over the last couple of years, I'm actually saying it's still a little bit like the Wild Wild West.
Yeah.
We all are like, oh yeah, okay, well that seems important and that's related to critical tasks and the severity is pretty high, so let's address that. Sure, correct. But that is often focused on design-related stuff. Now, let's say it's behavioral-related. Because it's a high severity, of course, we're going to have to address it. But how do we address it? Is it really just training? A friend of mine said, she's like, how do I make the engineers on my team see that what they're trying to do with their device design is change the human behavior? And right. Instead of adapting the design to human behavior, they're trying to adapt the human to the design, mm-hmm. which is always going to fail. And I'm very confident in saying always, because changing human behavior is, I don't know, it's such a can of worms that I wouldn't even know where to begin with and how to state that. But one of the examples would be what you and I have talked previously about, texting and driving. We cannot seem to eliminate this. So right. Why? Because it's human behavioral driven. It's, yes, as you so poignantly said before, it usually comes back to time. People always want to save time. Why do they not pull over? Why do they not safely situate themselves to text somebody back? It's usually time. Time constraints, not having enough, you know, whatnot. But it is fundamentally a human behavior to overestimate your capabilities and think that, well, let me just quickly text back a no.
Right. It's just a second. And I mean, I can go one further. We're in the process of publishing our second paper on the use of personal electronic devices during surgery. The first paper was the data was collected during cardiovascular surgery. The second one is during orthopedic surgery. And the number over 25 surgeries is in the hundreds. And I'm not talking about surgically related text and use. I'm talking about personal. I have to pick up my kid. I have to, you know, watching a movie on Netflix or a funny clip on not Netflix or YouTube, whatever you kids are watching nowadays.
You kid.
And so the idea, but the cell phone companies, the iPad, these companies, the social media companies have invested in understanding how to keep people glued to those screens. So they have taken advantage of a human behavior, the attentional side of it, and built on that. Changing human behavior is a concerted effort. We can look at seat belts as an example of that. That was a generational shift.
Yes.
Where people were very, very resistant early on. We came up with all kinds of engineering fixes, cars that beeped at us, cars that talked to us. People found ways to get around that. They disconnected things. They hitched them behind themselves. And in, over time, for one thing, we started really hammering people who weren't using seatbelts, charged them a lot of money. And it was really a shift in behavior that took quite some time. So it's not that we can't change, it's just really understanding the systems that generate those behaviors that's critical and how we talk about that. Because some of the behaviors that we see are design-induced. Some are not. We have to be able to separate those out. And we have to be able to say, is this generated by the task or the technology? Is the behavior generated by something in the individual, whether it's a mental state, were they distracted, bored, tired, whether it was some physical or mental limitation, something that would come very easy to someone in their 30s or 40s versus someone who's using a device in their 50s and 60s. What do those limitations look like now? Is it a coordination issue? Does it depend upon having other people there to use it effectively? Those are the kinds of things that we have to ask if we're really going to understand it. We can't view it as it's person-induced, design-induced. It's way bigger than that, because then we kind of fall back into that typical root cause analysis approach where we look for that one thing. And then, like you say, that leads to cherry picking. And the great thing about cherry picking is it makes us feel good. We've checked a box. And we've done something. So now we can press forward with a clear conscience and feel good about what we've done. But at the end of the day, it's often much more complex than that.
And just to add to your story about seatbelts, funny you bring that up. I just watched a documentary on totally different subject, but within it was interviews with people from the 60s and 70s.
Oh, yeah.
That showed when they stopped allowing people to drink and drive.
Oh, yeah.
And the interviews were just, I mean, with my 2024 mind looking at it, I'm just flabbergasted that people would state such ridiculous things. But you hear people say, now they want to tell us that we can't have a beer after work and drive home. And I'm just sitting there, I'm like, yeah, that is what we're trying to tell you. And with my mind today, I find it humorous and ridiculous, but that is the mindset that you're going up against. You're trying to change an entire way of thinking, perception, cultural thinking, societal thinking. It is fundamentally a combination of behaviors and of thinking. When you look at something like that, I then can't help but in medical device design, I can't help but think, how can we conform better collectively to a point where we can say, when somebody does X, Y, Z and portrays this in their behavior, yes, it may not be design related, but that is a critical indication that your design may have not been addressing the typical human behavior and standard, and you're trying to ultimately change somebody's behavior with your design instead of adapting to the typical workflow of that behavior. And that would be a great indicator for you to say, okay, well, on the surface, it doesn't look like it is design related, but that behavior typically comes from you trying to change their behavior. That is not great design.
Yes. So I think you've given a couple of examples, like the drinking and driving, the seat belts, smoking is another one. These were cultural shifts. That's really the issue. And so what you saw was a shift in culture. You saw a shift in the culture of aviation. So if you think about aviation in the 60s and 70s versus today, there's been a cultural shift in how we address human error, right? And safety in general. And medicine in general is fighting for that cultural shift that they saw in aviation. I would say in the last 12 years, I would be safe in saying that close to 50% of my work has been in healthcare in terms of safety, human factors, root cause analysis, and things like that. Whereas before, I could count on one hand. And part of that was because they saw what aviation was able to accomplish in terms of safety at the commercial level. Can we take those lessons and bring them over here? And you can if the culture supports that. Because the problem and the challenge is not a problem, but the challenge in terms of what we're talking about, right, is how do we implement that? It's always an implementation issue. I don't want to say always, but oftentimes it's an implementation issue. How do we implement people not drinking and driving? How do we implement people not smoking? How do we implement seat belts, not texting and driving? Those are the challenges. How do we implement a more common taxonomy to discuss human error? And that, I think, it seems that's a huge mountain to climb for a lot of industries, for any industry. It's a big mountain to climb. Not impossible because industries have done it, but it's not easy. And it oftentimes takes that shift in the culture to move people because we see it, like I say, I mean, who would have thought that you would see people on their phones in an OR or on an iPad. But when you look at it in general, if I look at pilots going through a checklist, it is ingrained in them that you do a checklist because for the pilot, if you don't do a checklist, there's a good chance something in there that you left out is going to come back and get you. And it's going to get you. I can count on one hand, after hundreds of surgeries that I have witnessed and watched the timeout briefing prior to the start of the surgery, how many of those were conducted in what I would consider a correct fashion, i.e., when timeout was called, did everyone stop? Did everybody listen? Or did people continue to unwrap instrument packets? Was the anesthesiologist continuing to set up? Was the perfusionist continuing to get themselves set up? And this, a clear violation in aviation, no question. This is not to say that the people doing the surgery are not well-intentioned, safe. I know they are, because I know these people. Well-intentioned, safe, wanting to do their best for the patient and for the team. But we oftentimes don't see down the road why that matters. It's hard to envision that, especially if you have success after success after success. You start to weigh the importance of these things less and less.
Well, I'm not sure if this is completely correct, but I do see a correlation to the whole statement I made earlier. We like to overestimate our capability. And when you speak about this typical behavior, like you so poignantly said, in aviation, it's ingrained in you. If I didn't do my checklist, my flight instructor failed me. I know exactly why. I can confidently say, had I not learned the checklist system, I would have gone up in the air so many times with things still attached to the plane that shouldn't be attached to the plane. Even if it's just the remove before flight pitot tube cover.
We've seen a commercial flight crash because the pilots left the pitot tubes covered. And a very quick glimpse at the NTSB accident database, looking at general aviation and some commercial, where you see fuel starvation as a major cause of accidents. So this goes back to exactly what you said, that we get very comfortable with the systems that we use, and we tend to be poor judges of risk in general. And that's on every level. That's around the house. How many times do people stand on chairs to change a light bulb or do something instead of going out to the garage to get a ladder? We know that's dangerous. How do we overestimate things all the time? How many serious accidents happen in the shower or the bathtub? People slipping, falling, closed head injuries, all kinds of stuff. And when we've sat back and said multiple times prior to that, I really should get some strips for that bathtub. It's kind of slippery. So we overestimate both our abilities, and we're very confident in how things are going to play out. And I think the problem we have at the risk, really, of getting statistical is what we fail to recognize is that both in terms of behavior amongst ourselves, within ourselves, and with other people, and with the technology that we interface with, how rapidly the degrees of freedom around a specific task increases, and what those degrees of freedom really represent. And that, I think, is where we struggle. When we look at people and say, what were you thinking when you did that? Well, they weren't thinking about that. The person standing on the chair to change a light bulb and then the chair falls out from under them, they certainly were not thinking about the fact that the chair is going to fall out from under them.
Or they were, and they minimized the risk.
Minimized the risk. What was the person who was texting while they were driving thinking? They weren't thinking they were going to wreck. They were thinking, like you said, it's going to be a quick, I'm just going to answer no, or I'm driving, I'll call later, and that's it. That very brief inattentiveness turned out to be, at that point in time, critical.
And we see this all the time with healthcare professionals, too. They base their judgment and their risk assessment based on familiarity often. A lot of nurses, a lot of surgeons, a lot of doctors, physicians, I don't know how many I've seen at this point, but thousands of people I have observed and interviewed during testing. How many times do I hear, well, once you know one injection device, you know all of them? No, you don't. Because you just injected the wrong dose. Are you even aware of that? I can't tell them that during the testing. They have to come to that conclusion on their own. But sometimes it is hard after such a long time in the industry for me not to go, why? What compels you to do that? So that's what you mean with what were you thinking? Because we, as the observer, we can be like, no, absolutely no. And so when I look at that stuff, and you were speaking about risk and our overestimating of our own capabilities and our underestimation of risk, let's also think about things like neurodiversity. So as a neurodivergent, I typically don't even look at risk like a neurotypical person. Granted, there's data that it takes a certain type of personality, intelligence, and character to go into certain professions. You will always have a very similar type as pilots. You always have a very similar type as surgeons, physicians, nurses. We used to say you had to be type A to be a pilot because you have to look at yourself as a god in order to stand above the intimidation of what you're actually doing. Same with a surgeon. You have to have some type of personality that allows you to have this ingrained confidence that you can do it better and perfect every time than anybody else. Because if you don't, you can't have a surgeon who questions every single millimeter of incision or every single task. You can't. You have to have somebody who's really confident at it. How do you get that confidence? Well, most of the time, it's practice. When you look at how do surgeons learn how to make incisions, how do they learn how to do stitches? They've practiced so many times that it becomes muscle memory. And once something becomes muscle memory, and that is one of the fundamental things that I think we have in driving, driving has become such a muscle memory. How many times do you hear people go, I don't even know how I got home. I just got in the car and then I was home. We zone out because it's become so second nature, because it's so muscle memory driven, that we don't even think about the actual task while we're doing the task. It becomes such a natural thing that you don't even think about the actual action of it. So then you get into this preconceived notion that you have become such a master at something that you can start introducing a little more risk because you've been doing it so long. And that's how I'm trying to correlate it to, for instance, the nurse who's done thousands and thousands of injections with injection devices. They often don't even look at the individual device anymore. They often make it dependent on what the drug is. So they say, oh, if it's insulin, well, that's typically in units. That's typically done this way, and it's typically recorded this way, and it's typically administered in these body parts. But did they look at it? Did they look at the device? Did they really look at the dosing? How's the dosing done on that device? So there's a lot of preconceived notions of how something works based on similar things, negative transfer. That is one of the things we categorize it as. So when I look at that stuff, it isn't unnatural for then the human factors expert, as you so clearly and perfectly said earlier, healthcare professionals are humans too. So what makes you think that they're going to be more perfect than somebody else? Yes, yeah. Their profession and training calls for it, but they are humans too. So they make the same kind of behavioral mistakes we do. And so one thing that really irks me in the medical device industry, and I'm usually very, very on board with most things FDA does, and I really enjoy working with the guidances, I think they allow us to get to a more collective thinking and understanding of things. But one thing that does bother me still in human factors specifically is we still call it guidances. And when we call something a guidance, we are taking away the importance and the criticality of this. Now, I understand that it is difficult to say it is a requirement for XYZ to do it in ABC. You do have to discern expert thinking. You, as the expert, you have to look at something and say, okay, for this device and this development, study design A is better. Hypothesis should be this, and this is going to be the best way to go at it. Yes, that is your professional expertise coming into the game. And that is most of the time why these documents are called guidances because they can't dictate a set way, because you have to adapt it to every single situation. But it is difficult to tell a manufacturer that, yes, it's called guidance, but it's a regulation. And it's not us saying, maybe. No, we're saying, this is how you're supposed to look at it. It is a regulation, and the person doing this should be a trained human factor specialist. Now, when you say we need something like in aviation, where we've already found that it improves everything, and that is when the turnaround came, that is still missing in medical device development. And that is what I meant initially in the beginning of our conversation when I said that is the vision I have. We need to emulate something that has that kind of thinking, that kind of building, that kind of collective agreement that we're going to make this, let's say, database, and we're going to feed all into it. And we're just going to go with what the data is showing us, because the data is where we go. And that allows us to build a robust theory statement. And when I look at that, I not only think it's critical to have such a database, such a collective accumulated thinking and definition and classification system. What I also, and this is something that you and I have talked about before too, but I kind of want to lead into, is we've also talked about that that is the way you actually develop data that is actionable in design.
Right. Right. So there's a couple of things there that you want to be able to look at, right? And one is, okay, once you've had a negative outcome, or outcomes, I should say, how do we go about addressing this? Once I understand what generates it, now I can produce interventions that are data-driven rather than just taking a shot and hoping I hit the bullseye, that those interventions that I use are actually based on sound data. That's number one. The other thing is it provides you with information about the process. So one of the things that we struggle with and have struggled with is that most of what we call safety, and if we talk about root cause analysis, error analysis, whatever it is, and safety systems are outcome driven, meaning that something has happened that is negative. So we've had a bad outcome. Now we have to go figure out what did it. And then we go through the whole process of figuring out, we do the root cause analysis, what generated this, what generated this. And then we write a report about it, and we go through the process of developing interventions, which is great. But a better means is to approach from the standpoint that we know there is no such thing as a perfect surgery, no such thing as a perfect flight, perfect drive. There are always little mistakes and errors that are made. Most of them, the vast, vast majority of them, are inconsequential in that they do not result in negative outcomes. But it's that one in a million, one in 100,000, one in 1,000 that do, that creates the problem. So the idea is that if you have data, and the right kind of data, now we can address the process before there's a negative outcome. And that's what we're really trying to get at.
And also, you just brought something up that always brings me back, and it still shocks me that some people don't know this in my industry. That's the whole theory of the James Reason Swiss cheese model. You make mistakes all the time. Nothing is perfect. But it is that one in a million where all those little mistakes hit it right in one line, and they all add up and lead to catastrophes. And that is the whole premise of why such a collective thinking on defining and classifying behaviors is so critical, because then you can predict what types of combinations, what types of behaviors are going to lead to catastrophes. Because maybe on day X, being a little tired isn't going to tip the needle. But on day Z, where you're understaffed, running out of time, stressed, hurrying, and it's a more complex procedure or device, now you being tired could be the tipping point. And that is the type of thinking we have to apply, because when I do root cause analysis and validation studies, for instance, I actually ask the people in the beginning whether they came off of a night shift, whether they had good sleep, how they're feeling. Now, that may sound like it's just a warm-up and I'm just getting a feel, developing rapport between me and the participant, but I actually check off my checkbox. Person seems tired. Person seems alert. Person is coming off a night shift. Person said, and I quote from one of my participants, "Oh, I took a quick nap in the car before I came." That is the stuff that will determine what the root cause analysis for a use error later is going to be. Because I now can understand, let's say this person made a mistake, and on the surface, it seems like it was like a slip. But now I have added data point where I know they haven't slept. And, oh, that might actually have something to do with why they didn't understand the instructions for use that most people in this study actually understood. So that allows me to discern a whole different type of root cause. Now, if I had known that this person took a nap in their car prior and just came off of a 12-hour shift, then I would have to tell my client, well, two people in this study didn't understand the instructions, where it would have been a generalized statement, but now I know that it was only one, and one could actually be an anomaly. And so when you start adding them up and then not really having an idea of what the basic root cause is, then you lead to assumptions and you make design based on this stuff and combine it with cherry picking behavior and all these things that we talked about. It becomes very difficult to say that that's actionable data or data that leads to actions in the design.
Well, because I would ask you a question here, because I don't know. I have an idea, or I have my own, I guess, thoughts on it. But I would say part of this is a mismatch between the researchers and the companies, maybe. What I would ask is that if people are coming to you to test a medical device, whatever that medical device might be, doesn't matter. My assumption is that what they're really interested in is, does the device work when put to use under certain parameters? So if it's an injectable device, can the nurse, the physician, or whoever's using it, can they use it in an appropriate amount of time, accurately, et cetera, correct? Whereas from your perspective, certainly from my perspective as a psychologist, my bias, if you will, and I'm happy to call it a bias because it's no doubt what it is, I'm more interested in the human side of that equation. You really have two sides of an equation. And what you're trying to do is kind of meld those. So like you, if I'm going to be doing a study, whether I'm using pilots, nurses, physicians, it doesn't matter who, I'm going to have an entire section, a survey of just demographics on that person. I'm going to ask them about their years of experience, their training. I'm going to ask them about their state. You know, have you had caffeine this morning? Do you normally drink caffeine? Are you tired? What's your sleep been like? Do you generally have trouble sleeping? How much have you slept in the last 72 hours? Are you sick? Are you on any medication that might affect your performance? Or even if you don't think it will, what medication are you taking? Those are all questions that we ask because we want to know the human side of the equation.
And to be fair, we do ask demographics. I don't want our audience who isn't in this field to think that we just go ham. I'm just trying to clarify that what we collect in demographics is a little bit more limited to experience. We do ask things about experience. How long have you been doing this? How many procedures have you done? Let's just take an example for a surgeon. How long have you been in your specialty? Is it your specialty? How many similar procedures have you done in the last month, year, in your career? Have you been trained? There's differences in surgeons. There's surgeons who actually teach. When you think about a surgeon who's teaching, they've now learned a whole different set of terminology because they need to teach somebody who doesn't know. That's a whole different skill. So they look at a task differently. So yes, we do collect demographics. In injection studies, we like to do dexterity scales. We measure hand span, like these things. Do you wear glasses? What's your vision? Do you have color vision issues? Do you have hearing issues if the device is with sounds and stuff like that? So we do look, I mean, I can't speak for everybody, but I do look at a lot of things. Now, what you're referring to is something that I actually do, and I do have issues sometimes with clients asking, why am I collecting so many data points, and why are my sessions longer? Why do I need 20 minutes of intro? Well, because first of all, I'd like to establish a rapport with the participant, because a good rapport is going to eliminate a lot of things. Intimidation, trying to please me. We know in usability testing that that is one of the common problems we have, and that is that the participant will try to please the moderator. It could be many different ways why they're trying to do this, but we know it is an issue. So I do collect a lot of data. My example with this particular individual who told me that they took a nap in their car prior to coming in, that was only because I asked the question of, did they come off of a night shift? And when this person then did commit a use error later on, I was able to trace it back to the fact that their alertness wasn't there. I mean, do I know 100%? No. But can I say this person hasn't slept since yesterday, 7 a.m., and their alertness is diminished? 100%. I can make that statement. That is one of the things that I'm referring to when I say we have to find a way to collectively agree upon certain circumstances and think of it more as a Swiss cheese model. Find these different types of things that lead to very typical and similar outcomes. And these outcomes are then defined A, collectively and agreed upon, and B, classified collectively and agreed upon. And then when we have something like that and we build this database, we can then, after a while and a certain number of entries, we can robustly and confidently say, when you have a situation A and you have behavior XYZ following it, it doesn't really matter what design you have anymore. Typically, outcome C is going to happen.
Yeah, because what you can do, and that's why what I was saying is that it's not that everyone out there is not collecting some demographic data. What I'm saying is that it's where your interests lie, which side of the equation are you coming from? And so the idea being that, like, if you use fatigue as an example, obviously, as you know, I've done a large portion of my work in fatigue. What? Because now we can start asking about all the different situations that people may use a device in. Because we know there's no question that any device that ends up in a hospital or in a person's home is going to be used by people who are at some point in time tired and fatigued. They've worked a long shift. They've worked overtime. They were up all night with a sick kid. The list of reasons why is effectively endless. But then we also know certain things about fatigue, that people who are tired, especially if it takes them a while to do something, they're going to start task shedding. So low demand tasks are going to start to go away. Little things that they should be doing don't, because they're going to take care of those high demand tasks and the other stuff just kind of goes away. We know that how they respond is going to change. And some of that changes in very predictable ways.
Of course, hand washing, alcohol wipes of injection site. Those are the two that just instantly pop in my head where I go, I am a trained human factors expert in medical device development, and look at me. Have I ever used an alcohol pad when I had to inject myself over the last couple of years? And the answer is no. Do I know that I shouldn't use the same injection site every single time? Yes. But do I also know that that is the most comfortable spot for me? So a lot of it is knowing and intentionally or behaviorally just adjusting. Do I know that I should not do this while being in bed? Yeah, but if I don't put it right next to my bed, I forget. So how do I combat these two things, right? Both calling for different procedures, but individually, I'm never going to do it. So now I have to combine them. And my best way of thinking is, okay, well, let me put it right here. I won't forget it. And that will guarantee that I actually adhere to a protocol. And so that thinking isn't unique to me.
No, and it's not unique to anyone. And I think the issue, though, is that by having the data, those are the things that you're able to pluck out. So like you said, instead of having just a one-off where you've happened to ask someone, hey, have you worked a night shift? But then if that gets folded into a database where other people have asked those questions, other people have been tested under those parameters, now you get some real meaning behind that. And again, doesn't necessarily mean it's one for one. It's a related factor. And when you take it in the context of everything else, does that add to the production of a certain behavior, whether that behavior is an error and doesn't matter, but you're looking to explain a very complicated thing, and that is human behavior. And you have to consider how many potential factors go into that, because the parameters under which you're collecting the data are one thing. The parameters under which these devices get used are very different. So that's the other issue. So it makes it very difficult if you can't really agree under what we would call, for lack of a better term, a sterile environment, behaviorally sterile, then it makes it much more difficult to draw conclusions once it's out in the environment in which its use is intended.
I mean, we don't even have to go far for that, because globally, we can't even agree what a sterile OR is, because I've conducted research studies globally. And I can without a doubt tell you that definition of sterile environment is not the same in every OR.
No, it's not. That's correct.
So when you say ensure that you have a sterile environment, well, what does that actually mean?
Well, what I was talking about, really not just sterile, I meant like behaviorally sterile. But yeah, if you can't even agree on what a sterile environment is. But again, that goes back to that level of comfort we have operating within whatever environment it is that we operate in. You said it very well. We get very comfortable driving cars. So if you do it long enough, you're going to get comfortable. And let's face it, it's hard to connect. When we look at all the protocols in place, and that's a good example, though, right, of maintaining a sterile environment. There's a lot of protocols in place. And people get very comfortable or lax with those protocols over the years, in part because it's very difficult to tie an outcome to it. If you're driving down the road and you take a wrong turn, that is a very tightly coupled system. But a hospital-acquired infection, not so much. How does a slight break in sterile protocol in an OR translate to a hospital-acquired infection? Did they get it in the OR? Did they get it post-surgical? How many different places in a hospital can you pick it up? Now, some of them, obviously, we can trace, but many are not. So my point is that goes back to what we were saying earlier. There's a level of comfort that we get with these things that is not always so well deserved.
Well, no. And I also think one thing that I'd like to hear on the end kind of add in, when we were speaking earlier about the examples of cultural shifts that have to happen in order for something to happen. You said when it came to the seatbelts, we started fining people really, really heavily. Push, change, a shift. So you use all the tools that you have in your toolbox. When it comes to human factors and medical device development, in the beginning of my career, I often thought, and I am already starting to smile because I know how ridiculous it is, right? But I already thought in the beginning, it was like, well, it's the FDA. Who wouldn't follow the FDA? If the FDA puts out a document that says, this is how you're supposed to be doing it, these are the definitions and the terminology, this is the process that you're supposed to follow, why wouldn't you? I mean, it's the FDA. As a pilot, I came from a world where if the FAA tells me something, then I'm going to follow it. But for some reason, we don't have that kind of environment in med device. So it comes more down to the fact who is implementing these things correctly and effectively. And you said earlier something that I'd like to bring in, because that really is one of the ways we have to look at it. It's implementation. So if the big pharma, the big med techs do XYZ, then the small startup is going to follow. So implementation is, as you said earlier, is such a critical aspect in this. You have to agree upon this is the guidance and this is how it should be implemented. And for that implementation, you need skill ABC. And this brings me to, and I don't want to delve too much into it, but this is unfortunately a part of the issue, is that we have in our industry somehow adapted this thinking that anybody can do human factors. We don't let anybody say they're an engineer. We don't let the engineer join the design team. We don't let the design team lead the regulatory submission. But for some reason, we are very lax with who we allow to do human factors work. And that is what I meant initially by the, if you're scientifically trained, you will look at something on a case-by-case basis, but you will try to remove the bias that you have. You try not to ask leading questions. You try not to bring your own biases in. You try to stay objective. That is why we formulate a hypothesis prior to data collection, right? That is why we already decide on the model, on the actual calculations, on the variables, on the study design. These are all things that we decide prior to data collection. And we can't veer from it, because if we start veering off from it, we are molding the data to what we want it to say. That's not what you're supposed to do. And so when you speak about implementation, it's the same kind of thinking. You have to agree upon an implementation process and way of doing and classification and terminology prior. You can't adapt it to every organization. When you do, outcomes are going to look different.
Right. I mean, they will. If you take something like safety management systems, right, which are required for certain aviation operations, they're encouraged for others. If you look at the FAA guidance, the FAA does not require all aviation operations to have a safety management system in place. And I'm not talking about, like, if you're flying like legacy carriers like Delta, American, United, Southwest, they are required to. Certain 135 operations are required to. But there are certain out there, the smaller ones, that 99.9% of the people would never fly on in the first place. They are encouraged to, and the FAA offers guidance for doing so, but there is not a federal requirement at this time.
And not to interrupt you, but just for the audience, 135 means commercial flight.
Yeah, that is a commercial flight, but it's a smaller one. That would be something like an air tour, helicopter EMS, or like an air taxi, but it would not be like the big planes that the typical person would fly. So there is guidance for implementing those things. And the FAA even has systems that you can avail yourself of to put in place. And so I think the issue is that implementation for smaller firms or smaller organizations will look differently than the big ones, but it doesn't mean that you can't have shareable information from those. And it doesn't mean that you can't have that or something along those same lines in place. But it's difficult. And I think the other thing too with regulation is, and I say this every time I teach, every time I do a training, I say the same thing, is that if all you have done is met the regulatory standards, the regulatory requirements, you've done the bare minimum for safety. You know, that doesn't mean you're safe. You've just met the requirements to open your door. And we want to move people past that point.
And the best in the industry go above and beyond. And I think that is very poignantly said. It is right on the money. And it's a wonderful ending to our conversation. Because this always brings me back to the, you know, if you're just going to do what it says, then you are really just doing the bare minimum. I mean, we had an episode prior where you and I talked about data, and we had a conversation about minimum participants in studies.
Yeah, 15 is the minimum, according to FDA.
Sometimes 15 is enough, and sometimes 15 is not enough. So if you're just going to do what it says word for word, then you're doing the bare minimum. And bare minimum is never going to be above and beyond. Above and beyond takes an expertise in the field to discern what that particular language in the guidance is actually supposed to be telling me. That is why, and this brings me back to my thing I like to preach all the time, these guidances are not written for the quality team. They're not written for the regulatory team. They're not written for the engineers. They're written for human factors experts. They're written for people who are trained in looking at systems and applying psychology to these things in order to have actionable outcomes, actionable data in design. And so to sum it up is the vision that I went into this conversation with you of, how do we have something like HVACs in our industry? How do you see something that we could take tangibly out of the approach that was done in, for example, HVACs? How could we start with that in our industry?
I mean, it's really starting small. If you have data, archival data would be a great place to start. Take it. Can we code it using HVACs, which we can? And then using that as a proof of concept, which is how we typically start. It's very much possible and it's doable. And it would be somebody willing to turn that data over. I mean, obviously de-identified, et cetera. And then just doing a proof of concept would be a very good place to start.
And I'd like to add to that, that is something that I've said many of times. You can start in your organization having that database, and you've worked on many projects, you've done many formatives, you've done many validations. Start accumulating that data. Start in Excel. I don't care. Just start building a database where you start to see a trend, a pattern that allows you to say, oh, this type of situation, this type of behavior typically leads to something that, you know, researcher A called it negative transfer, researcher B called it habitual. But really, what does it really mean? And let's come up with one way of calling it and one definition. And then from now on, we're going to use that. That's already a win. Well, that brings us to thank you, Bert, for joining us.
I enjoyed it. I'm glad to do it. And I look forward to the next one.
And just imagine James Earl Jones.
Yeah.
And the Chariots of Fire leading you out of the conversation. All right. Well, thanks, Bert. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And tell the audience how they can find you, Bert.
I'm a professor of human factors and behavioral neurobiology at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach.
And everybody can find you on LinkedIn as well.
I'm on LinkedIn as well. I'm right there.
All right. Thanks, Bert. Talk to you soon.
Great weekend.
Thank you.
And now a little sneak peek for you on what all we have in store for you during the upcoming HFES 2024 International Symposium on Human Factors and Ergonomics in Healthcare in Chicago, Illinois, starting this weekend. All right. Well, let's be real. I'm going to be super nervous this weekend because, believe it or not, for the first time ever, we're going to try to live stream directly from the healthcare symposium via Instagram Live. So, the way we envision this going down is that we will announce a daily agenda every morning with times and guests via LinkedIn and Instagram. And then all of you lovely folks who sadly could not join us in person in Chicago can then join us virtually on our live event and ask all the questions you want. Well, hopefully mostly around the event, okay? Anyway, We will have guests join us and live stream from special events like the reception on Sunday night, the keynote speech on Monday morning, and of course, many, many, many more. Hopefully, we can figure out all the technology in time and even invite the occasional viewer into our live to ask the questions directly to our guests or to me personally. So make sure you get a list going with all the things you'd be most interested to see and hear from the symposium directly in Chicago and drop them in the comments either on LinkedIn or on Instagram. I can't wait to talk with all of you. This is going to be so much fun. So I guess see you Sunday. All right, folks, that's it for today. Great discussion as always. And please do share your thoughts with us and comment wherever you're listening to today's discussion. And please do support the show, leave us a 5-star review, and tell all your friends about us, and consider supporting the Human Factors Cast Network on Patreon. Links to all of our socials and our websites are in the description of this episode. Thank you again, Bert, for being on the show today. Always lovely to talk to you, especially when it comes to our favorite topic of statistics. As for me, I've been your host, Heidi Merzad, and you can find me across all social media at HFUX Research. Thanks again for tuning in, and until next time, stay safe and effective.